We need to look better than other people, which is tough, but this is just the way it is. Now, when you're applying for an F-30 or F-31, you have to post your grades. And so this is going to be mostly for your science-related courses or those courses that are relevant to your career path. Usually people can overlook freshman bad behavior when you're an undergraduate, assuming that you are able, if you don't have terrific grades that first year or two, if you then shine later on, that's usually fine. Also, if you have any awards and if you are in any organizations, even as a graduate student, that is a national organization like the one that OPIC is in, this is helpful. Any awards that you've received make you look that much better. So again, sort of the higher level awards are good. Reviewers will also look at your background from your statement where you write about how you got interested in the research. Having a story about who you are and how you got there is fine, and as long as it's reasonably consistent. I've seen applicants who write, I did this, then I did that, and then I did the other thing, and basically it's not a coherent story. So you have to think more about a coherent story of your growth as a scientist. Your letters of recommendation cannot be lukewarm. They can't say this is a really good student. It has to say this is the best student I've had in 10 years. One of the best that I've ever seen, that sort of thing. They're looking for your referees have to be very, very enthusiastic about you. So this is now a good time in your career to start getting to know people who could be a referee for you by going to visit them, talking with them, collaborating if possible so that, they can write those kinds of letters about you. And then anything that relates your training experience to the proposed research training plan, and shows how the new research training is going to extend you, your training so that you can become eventually a leader in the field, is really important. The next section that reviewers, cover in the review, and you can get a copy of the review form from the grants.gov website. Your sponsors or any of the faculty that are associated with your training and research project is the next major category that reviewers will score you on. And the important points here are that your sponsor would be typically your primary mentor. And this person should be somebody that is closely aligned with the training that you are seeking. So it could be related to the research topic of your dissertation, but also to the field in general. This person should have NIH funding. I've seen fellowship applications where the person has had like cancer or other funding. That's okay too. But the main thing is that this person should be very accomplished and should have at least one or two grants that will extend beyond the current year so that their grant money will support you in your research project. So this is why it's important for them to have funding. They also have to have a track record of producing successful trainees, because they have to write a statement discussing their trainees and where they are, so presumably in tenure track positions somewhere. Especially if they're a junior person, which can happen, you may be with somebody who's an assistant professor, so they're not going to have necessarily that track record of putting out trainees. A good hedge is to have a co-sponsor who is senior to your sponsor so that it becomes obvious to the reviewers that even if your your primary mentor is relatively inexperienced, there's somebody that's going to cover that for you, because their job is really to give you individualized training for your particular research trajectory. It also is very important that the research plan was supervised by your sponsor. What this means is that there is a section in the application where you talk about who contributed to what part of the research proposal. And this does not have to be done completely by you. In fact, it should not be. And in cases where it's a relatively weak plan, I have seen reviewers say, well, they're not obviously being supervised properly. So it needs to have a very deep commitment from your sponsor. So it's not just the letters, but they have to work with you as you develop your research plan. They have to write a letter of commitment with specific plans for working with you. And this is true for every faculty member you work with. People often ask, well, how many faculty should I have? I don't think there's a magic number. Obviously, you can have too many, but it depends upon what your project involves. So if you're going to do something that's an intersection of two or three different areas, as you create your research program, then you may need to have a sponsor, a co-sponsor, possibly a secondary co-sponsor that each have expertise that are going to contribute to your fellowship. But it's not done in isolation. It's very, very helpful that your sponsor and all the faculty have a track record of having worked together previously, so that there are clear channels of communication, there is clear cooperation among them, somewhere along the line in the application, they have to talk about how often they're going to meet and discuss your progress. So part of this is to keep you from slipping through the cracks if problems arise. Along this line, it helps to have benchmarks of what your progress is going to be. And it's very, very important that there is consistent information about your plans for training and for the research. So I have seen situations where the sponsor pretty much understood how in fellowships you have to have certain elements, like that you're going to go to people's lab meetings, you're going to attend seminars and so on. And the applicant didn't sort of get that and didn't talk about that, or didn't talk about coursework that is specific to his or her research plan. And when that happens, it looks like there's been a failure of communication and that the candidate has not worked closely with the sponsor. So that's why it's very important that this is a very sort of tight kind of application, and it's the kind you'll have to do in the future when you're working with multiple sets of experts, where you have to really, it takes a long time, and you have to really put in the time to make sure that what you're saying and what your sponsor is saying and any of the other faculty collaborators are saying really is convergent. Okay, so the research plan training plan is the part that most people put most of their energy into. It's their dissertation in this case, it's your dissertation proposal. And that's very important. But I'm going to, again, emphasize that you can have an excellent, top-of-the-line, unusually outstanding. These are all magical NIH words. When we say that something is outstanding, it means that it's really, really unusually good. And that word suggests that it's going to give, that they're going to get like a very, very high score. But you can have that and yet not have a well thought through training plan. So in fact, I was just looking at one from a student who wants to consult with me. This is a person that had submitted an F-31 application, had a great research study, but did not have a great training plan and left a lot of blanks in that area, did not really get how well-defined that training plan needs to be. I'm going to be sitting and discussing with this person, so this is what you need to do. But this is pretty much, this is not unusual. Many people, especially if you have a more senior mentor, that's what it was like when they got their F award. It was like that when I got my, I had an F-32 long ago, and you could get, it was a lot more lax. Now it's very, very, it's very tough to be able to pass all the criteria, and all the criteria will be put together at the end in the impact statement that your reviewer will write about your application. So everything is weighted equally. So your research training plan, which is the research study, as well as the coursework and other work that you're going to do for your training. It's important for your dissertation that you conceive the research and that the sponsor has made it clear what part of it is yours and what part of it may be his or hers. And it also needs to be realistic so that the training aspect of the research, because usually when you're doing a dissertation study, you're going to be learning new techniques perhaps or new ways of approaching a question. And it's important that the training part of to be able to do that research competently is something that can be done realistically in the time frame. So the example that we see often is people think they can learn fMRI in 1 year, and without any prior experience, it takes a lot longer than that. And the reviewers know this because the reviewers are in oftentimes in those topical fields. Now, the other part of the research training plan is the part that I'm talking about that people often mistakenly underemphasize. So the main thing is that you have to you have to develop a research training plan that is unique to your needs and that it is much more oriented towards your plan for your career than just the normal program that you might be in. So if you're in an MD, PhD program, it's got to be a lot more than that. And this is also true for people that are in PhD programs, just straight PhD programs. So you'll need formal classes that will prepare you for conducting the research, especially if they're beyond the normal training. You need to have create a time frame so that you discuss your lab and your individual meetings with your sponsors, any lab meetings you will go to outside of your sponsor's lab, how often, if there are local meetings, for example, in Southern California, if you're interested in some aspect of neuroscience, there are numerous groups and within the entire Southern California area where you can take advantage of classes, seminars, and faculty. And one thing, it's harder for an F-30 or F-31, but just to mention to you, it is okay to have someone who's a faculty member as a sponsor for you who is not at your institution, because nowadays you can have webinars, you can have Skype, you can use other methods. It can't be your main sponsor that's at another institution. It really has to be where you are. But if you have someone whose expertise is very much needed for your training plan and that person is not available at your institution, it is reviewers don't necessarily have a big problem with a distance issue. With respect to your formal educational experience, it it needs to be clear that your sponsor has helped you select what classes or other experiences you need to have, which could mean working in someone else's lab and so on, still under the sponsor's guidance. Okay, so then there's a section called training potential where the reviewer has to say that the training experience that you are applying for between the dissertation as well as this research training, formal coursework, and lab meetings and so on, that it adds value. And so this is a watchword or a term that is always used, certainly when I was doing reviews. There was what's the added value of this experience? Because we want it to not be just a normal graduate experience. It needs to be something that is beyond the ordinary graduate experience. For example, you may normally within your PhD program, you may be expected to TA for someone or be an RA in another lab. And the whole point of the fellowship is to free you from that obligation so that you can concentrate on getting the research training that you need. It means that whatever you're doing is really your independent work. For some of these applications, you need to show that this is a major extension of your skill set. That's a relatively straightforward way of adding value to your research training, that this is really taking you into a new direction. Not so new that you can't learn it in a year, but new enough that it's going to move you in a way that you might not have gotten the movement otherwise. The institutional environment part is an important part of this. It's equally rated with everything else. And so whatever resources you're going to need to be in the section where it talks about your environment. And part of this is a letter of commitment that you will be spending your time doing the fellowship activities, as I said here, not teaching or doing clinical service. So the idea is that a very high percentage of your time is spent on those fellowship activities. And the environment also includes the intellectual environment that you will have access to the resources that you need in order to learn the things you need to learn so that you can begin to develop more and more independence in your research career. Okay, so do I have a couple of minutes, Abhik, or should I stop now?
How about this? Two or three more minutes, and then we'll begin with Dr. Lin. Or we'll continue Perfect. With Dr. Lin. I'll also add one announcement. If any individuals from the audience have questions they want to ask the speakers, please feel free to privately message me so that way it's a little easier for me to track, and then I'll just keep track of all the questions submitted and just read them off. So thank you. Please continue, Dr. Zielinski. Thank you.
Okay, so I just want to tell you how the review process happens. CSR, the Center for Scientific Review, does the F applications. And so reviewers may be in a so-called temporary study section. So they're not in a regular study section. I've been on cognition and perception since I'm a psychologist. But they will have a fellowship study section because there were so many applications that may be relevant to those topics. For those study sections, some reviewers are members of the main study section, others are not. But it's important for you to understand that your application, which is your own blood and sweat, basically, is going to be one of a whole bunch of other ones. Reviewers get a lot of applications, as many as 15 to 20, and they will be either the first, second, or the third reviewer. This has to do with the process of review. And the reviewers have to, they basically get your materials, and they fill out a form where they're putting in the strengths and weaknesses according to the different criteria that I've already mentioned, the candidate, the sponsor, the research training plan, the actual research proposal, and environment. So they don't have a lot of time, and they may get the applications about 6 weeks before the meeting, and now they've got to take time out from their schedule to do the reviews, and then they post them online a week to a few days right before the meeting, and they're asked to read everyone's reviews in advance so that they can possibly change scores or at least to be aware of what other people are saying. This is to save time in the meeting. The order of review is determined by the impact score, which I haven't talked about. The impact score is basically an evaluation and a paragraph or so where the reviewer takes all of your elements and says, as a whole, what is the likelihood that this person's project and this person's, the research project and this person will actually have a major impact on research, on clinical practice, or and so on. And so they're really looking for the most impactful trajectories. And so when they're writing the impact statement, they give it a score. I'm giving APIC all my slides, and one of the slides actually shows the scoring rubric that is used. You give a score for each of the sections, and then you give an impact score. That impact score is basically more than an average of the individual criterion scores. It's a general, it's more like a holistic kind of score. And that score is what's going to be posted, and it's going to determine your priority with respect to the study section meeting, because they can't, there isn't enough time to discuss every application. So they use an approach where about 50 to 60% of all the applications, except for diversity ones, are discussed. So that means that you may have the unhappy experience of being in that lower segment and you don't get a priority score and your application is not discussed. And it's nothing to be ashamed of. It is not unusual. There's almost an expectation that when you're applying, especially early on for an F30 or an F31, that you'll be sending it back for another review, and you have more opportunities to do that. So it's just how it is, and hopefully you can use the review information to guide the revisions that you will need to make in your application. So I think this is a good place for me to stop, Apik.
Okay, perfect. Well, thank you very much. And we will definitely provide these slides. Thank you very much for offering them on the APSA webpage in the coming days. So please expect an email for everyone in the audience if you'd like to take a look at the earlier slides.
Okay. I'm going to stop sharing, right?
Yeah, perfect. So let's see. So for Dr. Lin, if you would...
I'm here.
Perfect. I'm going to now make you the presenter.
Okay. Can you see my laptop?
Yes, so if you would now put it in this presenter view, or sorry, in PowerPoint slide view, and then I'll be great.
Sure, I will do it. Am I ready to go, or?
Yeah, please. Please go ahead.
Okay, great. Good evening, everyone. My name is Woody Lin. I am a program director, or in some institute called program officer, at the National Institute on Drug Abuse. And within the institute, we have several divisions, and I serve in the Division of Neuroscience and Behavior, and I'm a member of the training hub in the division, and also I'm a member of NIDA Research Training Committee member. So objective of my part of a presentation, actually just on another side of the coin that on the first part of the presentation is shared. Essentially, I'll try to focus on 3 points. Number one is to provide a few tips, because I was told the audience are emerging NIH fellowship applicant, the first time writer. And I want to pass a message that for all applicants, that not just looking for what you need to put into the application for now, and also keep eyes on the transition. So essentially right now, when you try to apply application, it's a transition from your previous stage of research to the fellowship application. For the same token, that now is the time also look into the phase of the transition. And also, you have put a lot of efforts come to the today's stage. So it's all about the investment in your career. So asking the questions, what's my long-term interest and my long-term goals? And also looking into what support available in the world to support my whole career track. At NIH, we have a series of fundings available to support investigators at their junior phase up to the full professorship and even go beyond that. And many information is available at the NIH website that is not possible to be covered within 25 minutes period. So those information, including details about NIH funding system, NIH grant application timeline, preparation for submission, terminologies, Office of Human Research Protections, Laboratory Animal Welfare, all of those are important, but not so critical for your purpose today, because those information you can find from NIH website. So today, what I try to cover is something that you probably cannot find black and white in writing. The first point is to try to come across is that really should be a reviewer in mind. In the first part of our presentation, we have heard many details. But the bottom line is that whatever you write and submit, that need to go through a review panel. So, and that's more than usually 20, 30 reviewers, and with 3 major reviewers will review your application. Bear there in mind, they are the people that will provide scores of your application. So, you know, so what are the 4 elements in your application? So those 5 points.
Pardon me for interrupting you, Dr. Lin. Would you mind speaking up a little bit louder?
Oh, okay.
Thank you very much.
No problem. It's better now, or
yeah, that's better. Great.
Okay. Yeah. So those are 5 elements that will be scored in each application. And now for applicants, the first part is to be prepared, or be very well prepared, that how you will sell yourself, sell your idea and your plans. And the plans, including the training plans, career development plans, research plans, and publication plans. There are at least 4 plans you need to include it in application. So the first of all is build up a credible resume and track record, of course. And I'm pretty sure this is not boring to any of you, but essentially, bear the dates in mind as well when you prepare for it, such as a publication. You work together with your current mentor, for example, doing rotations, and you have some interesting data that need to be published. And whenever it's possible and you have some level of control, talk to your mentor or your sponsor about the application and about the date that the application should be submitted, because it takes several months at least from submission to the papers that to be published even online. And also build up skills in scientific writing, grant writing. And if you've worked for the mentor for a long time and you propose to continue working under the same mentor's supervision, you may really need to consider at least add another one, another two, or a few more mentors. And the next point has been covered in the first part of our presentation. Essentially, this all credible recourse that can be added into your application. Just don't be shy to do that. And the next two points I will cover in my later slides. Essentially, talking about plan your personal interests to meet the funding institute's interest and priority. Now, the next part is the strong mentorship. That's the way I see it. This is at least the second and the most important for a fellowship application. So choose wisely who the mentor should be. You should be comfortable with the person and you can interact to develop a good, solid, strong training plan. And the person were committed to read at least your application, your proposal, and help select appropriate review committee. And the person were committed to your future. Not just need to write a support letter, but also to write something that will tail to your interest. And when time comes that let's need research support, because the fellowship essentially just provide you the salary, forget the time, but carry out the research is cost. And if the sponsor have sufficient funds, that will be safeguard to carry out your research interest. And the characteristics of a strong mentorship, including the person who is well known in the field, who has successfully trained others meaning that either fellows or higher level, like mentored K awardees. That's another mechanism of NIH, why I put a K here. And if the person is well known, but if this person is overcommitted, and we have here the reviewers saying, and this is a famous person, but he already has like 35 fellows that he sponsored. But that is not necessarily a no-go, but you need to consider add a few more additional mentors to make the team stronger. And again, this good mentor can provide some fundings if necessary for you. The final a point that I have mentioned at least twice, and it's worthwhile to mention again. Now, when we're talking about fellowship application, I mentioned there's at least four plans you need to incorporate. One is the training plan, another is the application plan, and the research plan, as well as a career development plan. You really need to take note that you do need to include at least those four plans into the application. And the application ideally should build up with a milestone, and the milestone meaning you can create some chart and easier for reviewer to read, to comprehend. And if the all aspect of proposed research that has been mentored somehow. And in the training plan, you really need to put the details about, what's about it, when some proposed event is happening and where it's happening and how it will be carried out. Career goals, development, skills, courses, seminars, and also how you will interact with scientific community beyond your mentor beyond the lab. So a checklist probably is a good way to prepare for. And that's something I see is very, very important, because there's something in your control, it's in your hand. Fellowship essentially is a training opportunity, a training event. So go back about 10 years ago, the training part probably is the most important, even more important than research component. And I'll address the research components later on. But that's the part that that's complicated. There's a lot of elements within the training plan you need to take care of. But that is something that you can take care of it well. And it's something you really should not let reviewers say, oh, well, this is weakness at this part, and that's weakness as part. Many weaknesses added up together that will draw down the score. So be prepared to avoid that happen to you. Now, I heard many of our F30, meaning MD and PhD dual degree applicants. So for F30s, definitely there are some elements that are unique. For example, you need to address the integrated research and clinical trainings. You have a plan for it. And we will expect to have a clearly enhanced individual's potential to develop into productive, independent physician scientists or other clinical scientists that is mentioned in the application. And clinical clerkship should be tailored to the applicant. And the dissertation research, that's a common part that's also shared with F30 fellowship application. But regardless of F30 or F31, that should be relevant to the missions of one of the participating NIH institutes or centers. And this part I will cover again later on. So I try to recap with this PowerPoint. Essentially, everything here is I have mentioned, or also in our first presentation, been covered. But this is a T32, a fellowship program director put it in his application. So essentially you can read through it, and that's covered the research training part, and also it covered professional and career training part, two plans with all those bullets that we have been covered. So this is a T32 that may cover the pre-doctoral and postdoctoral fellowship. But that's what they need to put it in there to win the reviewers' votes. So I just try to put it down here to let everyone know that similar elements are looking by another fellowship program. Now, in the writing, probably it's worthwhile to mention that you should pay attention to specifics and details in writing. We mentioned the plan should be tailored to the applicant. And what's the levels of detail? Now, for example, you should write, in 5 years, I want to be able to undertake this research program. And so far, I have the skills to do so and so. I need this particular training to fill in what gaps. And I will fill these gaps with these mentors and these activities. My training and this project will have a major impact on the field because of what? And also about writing details, instead of I will take statistical courses so and so, and compared to I will take math 300 introduction to population statistics offered by what department, for example. Those details will distinguish or differentiate one application from the another, so make your application stand out. Now again, details. After you put together your applications, go back, revisit it, and to see if all sections have sufficient details. If your choice for mentor, for the plan, for the project is well specified. Do you know your mentor and co-mentor's duty, that including the plans and including how much significant time you should spend in each library lab, and how many times that is set for one-to-one interaction, and how frequently the meeting will be. And reviewers want to know who you are today, so update all letters, because some mentors, they have many fellows, and they have template, which is fine, perfect fine, but just make sure you read your mentor's letter of support letter, and make sure that letter is tailored to your need. Now, we have covered the training plan. Now, how about the research part? Definitely, that's the area that you use to sell your idea and approach about the research. So, specific aim page, I assume that many of our audience are familiar with what it is. These are a few key elements that in every research plan, doesn't matter a fellowship or a senior investigator's research plan, that will all cover these key elements. Beyond that, you need to ask that if the specific aims proposed, they're concrete. And how about the approaches? Are there sufficient details in there? And you need to establish a theme to link the several aims that you proposed, and make sure there's integrations among the aims. And some reviewers may look for the innovative concepts. From program end, we do not emphasize too much about innovation part, because we understand this is a fellowship application. And usually the research is established, expanded from the sponsors, the current research, and that usually has been supported by either NIH or another federal resource. So from program end, at least, we're not particularly looking for the innovation. Or at least it's ideal to have the innovation part, but it's not that critical. And a few tips on the research plan is that, number one, again, sponsor is very, very important. Sponsor must review your proposal and should avoid interdependent aims. What I mean here is that if supposedly you propose like three aims, number aim one, aim two, and aim three, so you should avoid that aim one really depend upon aim two is dependent upon aim one. And what the drawback on that independent aim is that in case aim one doesn't work, then aim two would fail. And the reviewer will find that, and that is something that you really do not want to fall into. So do an integrated aim rather than independent. Now ask yourself, and get input from your mentors that you have sufficient preliminary data for all aims, preferably it is generated by you. Yes?
Pardon me for interrupting. We will definitely have a question and answer session in like a few more minutes, but I felt this question was relevant to this slide. One of the questions from the audience was regarding the statement to avoid interdependent aims and your recommendation to have aims that are independent and integrated. Would you mind clarifying that one more time?
Yes. So again, use the so-called standard three aims as an example, right? So interdependent usually means that the aim two or aim three were dependent on aim one or aim two. So if aim one established but cannot be proved, so cannot carry out, then M2 and M3 will fail. So each aim should be stand along somewhat, but they need also to be integrated, so interrelated. Does that answer the question?
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Sure. And also, I know some of our applicants are very well established, and they are very capable, and they have very, very strong track record, and they are probably, you know, can do more than just three aims in application. But for the purpose of application itself, just try to avoid overambitious. That would be considered a weakness. Nothing wrong, you go above and beyond what you propose in the application, but you try to avoid the impression that application is over ambitious, because when that happens, you need to come back, revise it, or you need at least provide feedback to address why, in your view, it's not over ambitious. And of course, in writing, it's very important to have very good logic flow of the whole application. And the research specific aim page is important. You can see it's a very condensed whole application. Everything supposedly that we will should find in the specific aim page and find interest so that the reviewers will go through in more detail to look into additional answers that they have the questions they raised in mind when they read the specific aim page. And ideally, if you can create some graph charts that to make reviewers easier to read, but on your end, you should make sure whatever you created, the graphs charts will agree with the text that you put in there. Now, at the beginning, I mentioned that probably it's important to blend your personal interest with the funding institute's priority. And that probably is no exception from, at least within NIH system, probably there's no exception for all the ICs who provide fundings. So for that part, you may look into if at least one of the sponsors conduct, for example, if the application to my institute, which is National Institute on Drug Abuse, right? So at least one sponsor's mentors is a NIDAP-NT. And do you and all your sponsors publish in recognized journals that relate to addiction science? And sometimes the institute website have specific areas of interest. For example, in my institute, in my division, we have a strategic plan. If you look into the website, you can find out those details. So my first slide is, you know, be very well prepared, and that's part of your preparation. I would like to end with the slides I borrowed from my colleagues. Essentially, this emphasized, you know, what role of my colleagues and I, people refer as PO or program of official, and you as a fellows, that we are here to try to help you. That's what we are paid for. So bear that in mind, that when you have needs, don't hesitate to contact us. And contact us early. How early? It really before you put together your whole application. Usually when you prepare for an application on the research part, you will start from the specific aim page, right? When you think about that. And when you have something put together as a concept, run it by your mentor and get his or her support, but also run the concept sheet, meaning the specific aim page, with one of the program officer official in one of the NIH institute. For example, if it's neuroscience related, that's my field, so I use it at NIH, we have 3-4 brain institutes, and we have a few institutes also carry out neuroscience related research. So ask program officer in one institute, ask program officer and another institute, in the third institute.
Yes. Pardon me, Dr. Lin. There was another question. We're going to begin our question and answer session in like a minute, but one individual asked me, regarding contacting program officers, what would you recommend? What would be the best way to reach them? Via email, phone? What would you recommend?
I would recommend to start with the email and practically, you know, either phone or email, but it's at least, you know, it's easier for the first contact with email, because many times they have multiple tasks and they may not be in their office. So you may run into the situation that you called and you did not get an answer. And if the patient is overwhelmed by a particular project, it will take like 2 weeks or even 3 weeks, he or she may miss your phone call. So email, every one of us is working on email every day, every moment almost.
Great.
And so start with email, it's a good idea.
Great. And I'm sure that information is also available on each institute's website as well. We just have to look up the program officer for their given institute of question. With that, we'll actually begin opening it up to the question and answer session. I received a lot of great questions from the audience, and so for the sake of timeliness and ending, not taking too much time of our faculty speakers, what we're going to be doing is limiting each question to about a minute or two, and I'll be very timely about the time. I'll be very cognizant of the time, pardon me. So the very first question we got was, roughly paraphrasing, what are the differences between the F-30, F-31, and F-32? And regarding the F-30, what percentage of applicants get awarded?
This is Liz. I only presented the F-30 applicant percentage, so it's 37%, and that's across all the institutes. You can actually you can literally put in F-31 success rate. If you want to know about F-31s, just Google it, and you'll get right to the page from the NIH website that where you can get that information. So if you have questions about other mechanisms.
Perfect. And regarding the first question, for trainee, just seeing all these different F series, like, oh my gosh, there's F series, there's a K series, so, and an R series. Oh, what is the difference between an F-30, an F-31, and an F-32?
Can our audience see this PowerPoint?
The audience can still see the PowerPoint. Perfect. Yeah.
Yes. So this PowerPoint essentially just tells answer the questions. So F-30 essentially is a mechanism NIH used to support the dual degree applicants. as MD, PhD, or some other dual degree. And F31 is PhD doctoral candidate that the Meta used to support. And F32 is to support a postdoctoral candidate. And on the very left column, I have the acceptable rate for F30 is 40% for the year 2014. And 32 is for F31 and up 30% for F32.
And
so that changes every year, of course.
Yeah, and
but it's about in a similar range.
Great, thank you. Before going to the next question, I would add that adding a comment to that, that I think there is some variability between institutes at the NIH. So it may be fruitful to look at the individual institute that you're requesting your application be submitted to. The next question we had from the audience is, can an individual resubmit an application more than once for the same project? For example, if I submitted an application and I did not receive a high enough, or I guess low enough impact score, a high enough score in terms of ranking, may I resubmit it again?
Of course.
Are there any stipulations for that, or is there a particular time that I need to do this within?
I think it's difficult for F30 because the landmark has been very well established. So the amount of time that for F30 candidates to get involved in the research is limited by the program. For F31, much flexible.
Thank you. The next question, there have been a few questions about preliminary data. So to roughly fuse them all together, how common is it for trainees to have preliminary data for all three aims? This might be difficult to accomplish in a small period of time for trainees and for the purpose of the fellowship. How much preliminary data is proper, and how many figures or sub-figures would you recommend?
Liz, can you cover this one?
Okay, sure. You don't have to have three specific aims. Let's be clear about that. You can have one specific aim. Two is good too. You don't have to have a whole lot of them. So it's important to understand that it's really tailored to what your research questions are. The preliminary data may be useful if it's a very new paradigm. If your preliminary data is actually based upon what somebody else has published, and what you're doing is a clear, sort of innovative and yet, you know, consistent pathway, from existing data, you don't need a whole lot of preliminary data. I think that reviewers are, okay with that. It depends on how, I guess unique the research question you have is, and if the justification you use for pursuing that work if it's managed pretty well in your significant section, then you may not need a lot of preliminary data. It's usually more of an issue at the higher levels. So like the F awards, there's an expectation that somehow your dissertation leads to your postdoc or to some of the later in your career awards that you have preliminary data. But it's not as – I think – we really see the early Fs, the F30, F31, as really, you know, very early in the person's career, and they've been busy taking classes and doing clinical work, so they don't have quite as much time to generate that preliminary data.
May I expand a little bit? In my view, the preliminary data is not necessary that the data that has to be generated by the fellowship applicants.
Right.
We understand you are at the beginning of your career, research career, and preliminary data essentially is something that's used to test the feasibility of the proposed study. So even if preliminary data generated in by your mentor, by the sponsor, that as long as it serves the purpose to demonstrate, use as a track record to demonstrate the feasibility, that should be okay.
Great. With that, I'm going to move to another question. This has to do with co-sponsors and the sponsor team. So in your opinion, do reviewers prefer seeing co-sponsors that, so that our, project, so that a particular project will span multiple fields? It might be difficult to ask busy people at other universities to co-sponsor and meet for an hour per week. There has been a trend for team-based science and getting interdisciplinary projects, but so how much should fellowship trainee applicants look into that when writing their grants?
Okay, I think that they should not feel that it's necessary. It's more relevant to the specific details of the project. Hopefully you have a very good fit with your sponsor, your primary mentor, so you don't need, lots of other people. But if you do, they don't have to meet with you every week either. Let me be clear about that. The idea is that, they will need to spend a certain amount of time mentoring you if you need to learn something that you cannot learn in your primary lab. So, it's not, you don't have to do that. I just want to be clear about it. If you have, a sponsor who is very busy, you may want to be able to, think about a strategy for seeing that sponsor and then maybe having your co-sponsor, put in the time for it. It could be that your co-sponsor is a more junior person. I talked about having a senior person for your sponsor and a junior person for your sponsor and a senior person for your co-sponsor, but you can have the reverse situation. The main thing is that you get what you need from the person you need it from. And, it doesn't have to be an hour a week. It can be less. It's just, it could be, an hour every 2 weeks or once a month. It depends upon how intensive the specific training you need to get from someone other than your sponsor would be.
That's a very good point. And also in my presentation, I emphasize or I probably overemphasize that, you know, the sponsor should be a very well known in the field. That usually is true, and usually that at the review panel, reviewers are looking for that. But I will give you the audience a different story. One of my grantee, who is a junior, so-called independent investigator, and she has already mentored like three fellowships, and she is the primary. No question at all on her credit and history. And the reason is this, you know, the mentor herself, she went through all the steps of NIH grant applications, start from fellowships, F31, F32, and K awardees, which is a mentored awardee. And before she get R01, which is independent investigator, very standard application. She got R21, and during the phase, she is only R21 principal investigator. Before she even get R01, she has already started mentor fellowships, and her credit has never been asked, simply because enough details is put in there to describe about this particular mentor and her track record of going through all the NIH applications and successfully carry every single one of them out, give the credit and convince the review panel.
Great. Another question that we got from the audience was, with time permitting, of course, would you both touch upon the differential funding rates between institutions and, how would you recommend trainees looking at different institutes for their project? For example, if a trainee has a project that's an intersection, as an example for me, I'm familiar with this. NHLBI, as well as NCI, both accept projects related to hematologic malignancy. So the project could fit into two different institutions. How would you, as a trainee, look into which institution to prefer sending your application to? And actually, taking a step back, would you mind describing for the audience the process of submitting your application to an institute?
Okay, let me start it. Now, if you feel that your research interest will fit into more than one NIH institute, contact a program officer in both institutes. As I mentioned, create a concept sheet or specific aim page, run it by your mentor, and revise it and to the level that you feel that will address your personal interest. Then contact simultaneously both institutes or three institutes and ask specific questions that if my research interest will fall into the general area of interest of your particular interest institute, and if so, to what level? In other words, if it just falls into a very general interest, or that will hit into your institute's high research priority. So ask specific questions.
Yeah.
Now, go ahead.
Okay, I was going to say one of the other questions was about the funding within each institute. Institutes each get different amounts of funding. Cancer gets the most. So you can look that up. That's all available on the NIH website. So you can see as Abhik said, you can look up for a given mechanism that you're interested in, like an F30. You can look up what percentage of funding there is for each institute that does funding. Because not all institutes, I don't think, do certain mechanisms. So you could check that out. This is why program officers really are your best friend. Because if you talk to a program officer in each institute you might be interested in, they can give you that information. Also, each institute on their website has what their priorities are. And so that would be very important. One of the things I want to mention about program officers are your advocates. And if you have a score for your proposal, and if PO can actually go and fight for you in council, so that if you have something that's a little bit on the edge, but it's really, really close to, it's really so close to what program is looking for, you may have a bit of a leg up in getting funded. If on the other hand, you could have a really, a perfect score almost, and if it's not within the priorities of that institute and staff don't think that it is, then they may not encourage funding of that. So it's not just having a straight number. It's also having allies who can help you and who can support you in what your research projects will be.
Thank you, Liz, for the magic words.
Yeah. I was just gonna, if I may add, I think one other point to also add would be that I believe it's the cover letter that trainees also, what institutes they would prefer to send their, application to, correct?
Yes. Further than that, it's not just the institute, it's the study section.
Yeah. And so.
And that's really helpful because that's listed. That's all public information. You can see who's on the study sections each have their own, sets of expertise. So you can again look that up. It's listed and who's on it. The regular members of a study section are also listed.
Yeah. So I think, as a take home message for that question, looking up each institute and contacting their program officers, as well as looking up relevant study sections, would be very critical for at least for fellowship applications. So definitely doing some homework in that will be of great aid. To the next question, this is kind of a specific question, so I'm trying to phrase it to not really deal with that particular institute in question, but one applicant was applying for a particular institute that no longer accepts F30s from institutions with NIH funding, and according to their website, have been advised to apply to an F31. However, my training plan, according to them, is geared towards a physician-scientist path. What would you recommend? Would you recommend them applying for an F31, seeing if their application is applicable to other institutes? Please comment what you think.
Again, I would say this is where a program officer would be very, very helpful because they can answer those sorts of questions, I think.
Now, for an institute who has decided not to continue a mechanism like F30 in this particular case, it's very, very unfortunate. I just hope the applicant is not falling into the situation that in the middle of a F30 application, then it is just probably have to start all over again. Because mm-hmm. that fall into the situation that one project will fit into one particular institute most likely will not fit into well to other institute without a major revision. Mm-hmm. So now, in this particular case, mentor actually also can help to redirect to the other institute. So what I'm saying here is that now if the institute decided to not support F30 anymore, really there's not much that a particular institute may do. But you can contact if it's already submitted, then you may consider contact the institute program officer who is in charge for F30 and ask the same question that you are asking here. What should I do? What other institute that you can direct me to? I expand that a little bit. I will come right back. So when you contact any institute program officer for any questions, that you may not first time find the right person, but we are trained to help. So meaning that if we find that this is not to my area of expertise, we will redirect to the appropriate person. And that person probably is not the perfect person. And we will all work together to find a best person for you. And if we feel that our institute is not the best institute, we will point it out to you. But the key is that in the contact your program officer at early part of your application. Now let me pull back. The mentor also do not underestimate the importance of your mentor's role here. That I have been found in my everyday practice that usually, well, either our applicant did not give us the impression that their mentor plays significant roles, or probably that's true that the particular mentor or mentors did not provide sufficient support to the applicant. But mentor, you know, if they are really committed to your success, they should be very resourceful, because oftentimes a well-established mentor, they are grantees for more than one institute. And sometimes they may have grants in more than two institutes. So they should be a very good resource to provide some answers that you're looking
for. Great. We got two more questions from the audience. The first question I'll ask is, regarding the deadline of 48 months for the F30, when does the 48 months begin? Does it begin at point of matriculation or their very first week of medical school? What is the start date for the 48 months?
That's a good question. I have to double check to get a perfect answer for that.
Okay.
So I do not have an answer ready for it.
No.
I do not want to mislead.
No problem. And what we can do is, for any additional questions that students may have, please feel free to look at the Medstro discussion page that APSA has a partnership with, or email me privately and we can follow up with the speakers at their discretion. The next question was regarding to are there any resources or places that you recommend for samples of successful applications that would be available publicly?
Such a thing exists, doesn't it? I know for NSF they have it. I'm sure that NIH does also. I don't remember what it is though.
Yeah, now at NIH, two institutes. Well, let me start. One institute is very particularly strong in providing information and very good useful information with good reputation. That's General Medicine, NIGM. Over there, if you look into their website, all the questions there has been asked, you will find answers there. So, and that oftentimes we were, as a program officer, we were even looking to their website because they have a long history and with a very strong reputation. And another institute is in AID, National Institute of Allergy and infectious disease. And also, if you just Google, that's part of the homework that worthwhile to do. That if you Google NIH website, you will find more information than you are willing to read, probably. So this is not a bad idea to come open to this type of presentations. Because within a short period of time, you probably will get information that is really streamlined to your needs. For example, it's tailored to the first time writer. So for that reason, I cut off at least like 20, 30 PowerPoints that may be important for people who are ready, who received the F30 or F31, so during their tenure. So they need to learn a better manage of their projects. And the many questions can be asked, but I cut all that out because I want to target on the needs of our audience tonight.
And with that, I wanted to thank both of the speakers for their time and for talking to us today and tonight, pardon me, for the time. And for everyone who is still on the conference call, thank you very much for your participation and great questions. Again, please feel free to post any additional questions to the Medstro discussion page or contact me at my email address, which is in the initial email, with any additional questions, and I will follow up with the speakers pending their discretion and time, of course. Thank you again for joining us for APSA's first interactive session, and please join us in our next interactive session, where we'll feature Dr. Brian Drucker and the story of imatinib. So thank you very much. Take care and have a great night. And thank you, Dr. and Dr. Lin, for your time. Good night, everyone. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. Good night.
Thank you very much.